I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Over the last few months, America has become awash in legislation that restricts access to abortion. Alabama, Georgia, Missouri, Louisiana, and several other states have passed laws that would limit abortion more than at any time since the landmark Roe v. Wade case was decided in the Supreme Court 46 years ago. Some of this legislation includes so-called fetal heartbeat laws, regardless of whether or not pregnancy is the result of rape or incest. Some laws simply prohibit abortion under any circumstances. Are these laws designed as precursors to overturning Roe v. Wade? I'm joined today by an attorney from Americans United for Life, the CEO of Narrow Pro-Choice Maryland, and a constitutional law expert to talk about the state of abortion rights. That conversation's coming up on Midday after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Since the beginning of this year, 9 states have passed laws that seek to ban access to abortions. Some of the laws passed in Alabama, Mississippi, Ohio, Georgia, Kentucky, Arkansas, Louisiana, Missouri, and Utah are so-called heartbeat laws that prohibit abortions once a fetal heartbeat is detected. Some make exceptions in cases of rape and incest. Others make no exceptions and prohibit terminating pregnancies at any time. Other states, including Iowa, South Carolina, West Virginia, Florida, and Texas, either passed bills that have since been blocked by a court or they failed to pass in both houses of their bicameral legislatures. Roe v. Wade, the landmark Supreme Court decision that legalized abortion, has been the law of the land for 46 years. At least some of these state statutes are designed to be challenged in the courts with the intent of giving the Supreme Court the opportunity to overturn the landmark 1973 ruling. So today on our program, a conversation about the state of women's reproductive rights in America. Diana Phillip is the executive director of NARAL Pro-Choice Maryland. That's the National Abortion Rights Action League. She's on the phone from her office in Baltimore. Ms. Phillip, welcome.
Thank you.
Stephen Aden is the chief legal officer and general counsel at Americans United for Life. It's an organization that opposes legalized abortion, and he joins us from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. Mr. Aden, welcome to you as well, sir.
Thanks, Tom. It's a pleasure.
Kim Whaley is a professor on the faculty of the University of Baltimore School of Law, and she joins us on the phone from Washington, D.C. Professor, welcome as well to you.
Happy to be here.
We will begin taking your calls a little bit later in the program. For now, you're welcome to drop us an email or send us a tweet, midday@wypr.org. That's our email address. Our Twitter handle is @midday_WYPR. So, Kim Whaley, I wonder if we could begin by asking you to give us a little primer on the constitutional justification for Roe v. Wade, how this case was argued back in 1973. It's really quite an extraordinary story. The attorney who argued the case, a woman named Sarah Regal at the time, was 27 years old, and she won this case in the Supreme Court. What parts of the Constitution did she look to convince the court to decide as they did?
Well, there are two parts of the Constitution that are relevant here. One is the 14th Amendment, and the second is the 9th Amendment. The 9th Amendment did not become something that was important for purposes of this case. Really, it comes down to the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment has a lot of stuff in it, including what's known as the Due Process Clause. So there's actually two Due Process Clauses in the Constitution. The 5th Amendment applies to the federal government. The 14th Amendment applies to the states. There's no amendment that applies to private parties. So essentially, in a case called Meyer versus Nebraska in the early 20th century, there was a challenge to a law that limited the ability of teachers in the public school system to teach languages other than English. And there was a 7th grade German teacher that was prosecuted for violating this law. That went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, you know, due process generally, when you think of due process, it means before government can take your life, liberty, or property away, you have to have a hearing. You get a trial or something less than that. So it's really procedural. This guy got his procedural due process. He got his trial. The court went a little further and said, you know, there are certain sort of rights or liberties or concepts of liberty that are just bound up with freedom itself, and that includes the ability to rear and educate your children as you want. And so that's, I think, the first case in which the court sort of extended this concept of due process to mean not just procedural protections, but something more, an actual right. And really, Roe versus Wade piggybacked on that line of cases and said that right to sort of have government stay out of your personal business includes a right to privacy that encompasses a woman's right to make medical decisions on her own behalf. And that is the linchpin of Roe versus Wade and the decisions that followed it. There was another argument under the Ninth Amendment, which says the enumeration of rights in the Constitution doesn't constrain other rights. So some people argue, listen, that's a way to say the rights that are in the Constitution aren't exclusive. You can add on to those rights, but the Supreme Court has never sort of taken that argument and run with it. It's, the Ninth Amendment is pretty vague, and it doesn't do a whole lot of work anymore. It really comes down to what's known as substantive due process, and substantive due process doesn't just protect abortion rights. It protects other rights that aren't specific in the Constitution, like the right to raise your child as you wish, the right to make your own decisions about your medical care, the right to go from state to state without government barricading your ability to cross state borders arbitrarily. These kinds of things that Americans walk around believing that are their rights are not expressed in the Constitution. Abortion is one of them.
So the Wade of Roe v. Wade is a man named Henry Wade. He was the district attorney in Dallas, and he was responsible for enforcing the anti-abortion statute in Texas at the time. This case came before the court, I guess, first in March 1970, something like that. And Roe was referred to Jane Roe. The real name of the woman was Norma McCorvey. When the attorneys arguing against the ultimate decision made their case, as I understand it, they argued that the state has a duty to protect prenatal life, and they argued that life is present at the moment of conception. Did the Supreme Court justices rule on that factual stipulation? Did they decide, as it were, when, in fact, a human life begins?
No, they declined to make that particular decision, but they did recognize that the state has an interest in protecting the life of a fetus. There is an interest there, and that interest needs to be balanced against the interests of the woman. This is typical of Supreme Court jurisprudence. Very few parts of the Constitution are black and white and clear as a bell. The court does a lot with what we know, lawyers and law professors and judges, what we know as a balancing test. They say, listen, you have this on one hand, you have this on the other hand. And the court said, in this instance, we are going to create basically a test that divides a pregnancy into three trimesters. In the first trimester, government's interest in protecting the fetus is certainly pretty minimal in light of the woman's interest. In the middle trimester, that there's some medical conditions that can justify abortion or not. And then in the third trimester, that's where the state's interest is the strongest. And then in a later case called Planned Parenthood versus Casey, the court sort of did away with the three trimesters test and basically reframed this balancing test to ask, listen, did the state impose a restriction on abortion that has an, quote, undue burden on the woman's right to make decisions about her body, make decisions with her body without government telling her what she can and can't do? This is not dissimilar to, say, gun rights, right? People don't want government coming in and saying, you have to give up your guns. Abortion rights can be framed that way, too. Listen, it's about government having an impact. The moral decision is a separate issue with respect to the woman's individual choice and religious implications, et cetera. So the test currently is there an undue burden on the woman's right to choose? In that Planned Parenthood versus Casey case I mentioned, the court said, you know, requiring women to tell their husbands, that's an undue burden. But of course, this gets quite subjective, and this is what we're seeing with the various laws now across the country. The question for the court, if Roe versus Wade itself, recognizing that 14th Amendment due process bound right to privacy, if the court protects that, the question will be, how much are these basic, you know, these infringements on the ability to get an abortion, how much are those so undue that they eviscerate the woman's right itself? The government has an interest in protecting the fetus, but that interest cannot overcome the woman's interest in her constitutional right to privacy that the court recognized first in Roe versus Wade.
We're talking about abortion and reproductive rights here on Midday. Kim Whaley teaches at the University of Baltimore School of Law. Stephen Aden joins us as well. He's with the Americans United for Life, and Diana Phillip is the executive director of NARAL Pro-Choice Maryland. Mr. Aden, let me move to you here. These state laws, there's kind of a tsunami of them. There's a whole bunch. Are these, in fact, intended to challenge Roe v. Wade, and is there a coordinated effort, an overarching effort behind all of these laws with that intent?
Yes, Tom. Actually, there have been a tsunami, I do use that word, of over 400 pro-life bills that have passed in the states in about the last 8 or 10 years. One of the reasons is because the Supreme Court in Planned Parenthood versus Casey in 1992 junked the framework that they used in Roe versus Wade to determine how to balance the woman's rights against the state's right to protect and preserve life in the womb. And they went with, as Professor Whaley said, a pre-viability, post-viability framework. But in doing so, affirmed in Casey in 1992 that states do have an important role to play in regulating abortion like any other medical procedure, any other outpatient procedure. It's similar to protect the health and safety of women. So a lot of states have picked up on that and sought to regulate abortion as an outpatient practice in order to protect women's health and safety. Now, recently, a small handful, I think, of states have indeed taken up very early abortion restrictions, like the heartbeat bills that you mentioned, other forms. Personhood is another example of early gestational limits that some states have looked at. I think it's true, the stated purpose is to challenge the continued viability of Roe and Casey in the Supreme Court. They think that with new personnel in the court, particularly Justice Brett Kavanaugh, that there's now a pro-life majority on the Supreme Court, and the time may be at hand to ask the Supreme Court to reconsider its determination in Roe that there is a right to abortion in the Constitution. As Kim pointed out, it's not in the Constitution. It's, as the Supreme Court said, it emanates from the penumbra of the Bill of Rights. They never could find a proper place to locate it. In fact, even they started in Roe saying it was a privacy interest, and then in Casey in 1992, they decided it was a liberty interest under the 14th Amendment. Oddly, it's not in the 14th Amendment or anywhere else in the Constitution, but the right to life is. And that's the right to life that Americans United for Life seeks to support and protect as we work with many of these states across the country to pass good, sound, constitutional legislation to protect women's health and safety in this surgical or chemical medical procedure, and to affirm the humanity of unborn babies in the womb. Because after all, they're members of this, they're human beings in the womb, and they ought to be treated as such. And that's what the Supreme Court actually said last week in the Indiana Fetal Remains case.
And that's a different case, and perhaps we'll get to that if we have time. But do any of these laws recently passed, like even just since the beginning of this year, the nine that I mentioned, did they strike you as good cases to bring before the Supreme Court if the intent is, in fact, to have Roe overturned?
Well, strategically, I do not think it's likely that these very early gestational laws will make it to the Supreme Court. And here's why. We think that the Supreme Court is not ready to take up a case that directly challenges Roe versus Wade. So you see, like last week in the Indiana case, the Supreme Court narrowed the grounds on which challenges could be made to state abortion laws. That's one step in the right direction, but we think they'll take possibly several steps in that direction. And these early gestation limits are really too much too fast.
But what makes the court ready? How do you know the court's going to be ready?
It's very simple. You need four justices who would take the case, because any case requires four justices to vote to hear it, and they only take about 2% of all cases that are presented to them. So you need four justices to take a case out of the nine, and essentially it's four justices who are willing to bet that they'll get at least one more vote when the case is considered on the merits by the court. And I do not believe that there are four pro-abortion justices currently on the court who are willing to take the bet that there's one more vote to affirm, at least in a resounding way, Roe versus Wade and the principle of abortion that it adopted.
Okay,
so I think that we'll wait and see something else come along. Like, for example, the court has already signaled that it may hear a case out of Louisiana involving whether Louisiana can require abortion providers to have admitting privileges to admit a woman to the hospital in emergency circumstances. So we're looking closely at that one.
Mm-hmm. Let me move to Diana Phillip. Ms. Phillip, thank you for being so patient this afternoon. What is your focus with NARAL Pro-Choice Maryland, and do you expect a challenge to Roe in the near future?
Our focus is on the state of Maryland and protecting the rights that we already have in accessing abortion care. I do expect that there may be some cases coming down the line. I hear that in June 2020, we might see something in the Supreme Court, but I really don't know enough about all the cases that are progressing throughout our federal courts, because there have been so many and there will be so many, that what the Supreme Court actually decides to take on, that's really up in the air.
And what's going on here in the state of Maryland? Do you see movements to restrict abortions in our state as well?
Well, in our state, in the last legislative session during the Maryland General Assembly for 2019, we saw a record number 16 anti-choice bills that had been introduced. I mean, you usually see only five or six. So, yes, people are feeling on the side of the anti-choice movement, very emboldened by the Trump-Pence administration, since both Trump and Pence have promised some form of punishment, or as Trump, well, actually Vice President Mike Pence promised on the campaign trail, that we'll see Roe v. Wade consigned to the ash heap of history where it belongs. And so, especially with a new legislative session with 61 new legislators this past session, some folks were trying out, you know, cutting their teeth on the idea of introducing bills, and we had a few more anti-choice bills than usual.
Diana Phillips, the executive director of NARAL Pro-Choice Maryland. We're joined as well by Kim Whaley. She teaches at the University of Baltimore School of Law. She's got a new book out I'll tell you about in a minute. Stephen Aden is the chief legal officer and general counsel at Americans United for Life. We'll take a quick break, and when we return, we'll take your calls and comments. 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. To follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHall. WYPR. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up Monday, it's Midday on Foreign Affairs. We're going to talk about the recent elections in Israel, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's future, given his inability to form a government, and the Middle East peace plan formulated by Jared Kushner on behalf of the Trump administration. That's coming up Monday on Midday. Also, this news from the Baltimore City Police Department. Last night at a press conference at 10 o'clock, Police Commissioner Michael Harrison announced that a 24-year veteran police officer, Sergeant Ethan Newberg, has been arrested and charged with second-degree assault, false imprisonment, and misconduct. Mayor Jack Young and City Council President Brandon Scott both praised the commissioner's actions, which were prompted by body cam footage that showed that Newberg arrested a man in an incident that unfolded much differently than Officer Newberg had described originally. We'll have more on this in the coming days as this story continues to develop. If you're just joining us today, we're talking about abortion rights in light of a spate of state laws that have been passed in recent months that restrict access to abortions. My guests are Kim Whaley of the University of Baltimore School of Law. Her new book will be released at the end of the month. It's called How to Read the Constitution and Why. Diana Phillip is the executive director of NARAL Pro-Choice Maryland. Stephen Aden is the chief legal officer and general counsel at Americans United for Life. We'll try to work in some of your calls and comments here on Midday. 410-662-8780. That's our phone number, our email, midday@wypr.org. And you can drop us a tweet at @midday_WYPR. I would like to go to the phones to David in Hedgesville, West Virginia. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Tom. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. You're on the air. What's on your mind?
Okay, I just wanted to say I think that Roe was decided correctly, but for the wrong reason. I can think of no greater example of involuntary servitude than for the state to require a woman to bear an unwanted child. So I think it violates the 13th Amendment, which is in concrete and not the ether of privacy or whatever.
All right. Well, thanks for that comment, Kim Whaley. What do you think? I mean, was it decided correctly, but for the wrong reasons?
Well, I think the caller makes a really excellent point in underlining what these amendments are all about. And I know Mr. Aden mentioned that the word person is in the 14th Amendment. But the 14th Amendment, like the 13th Amendment, is about limiting the government's power over persons. Actually, the 13th Amendment is extended to private parties. It's the only place in the Constitution that that's explicit. But so the idea here is, what is government doing to limit someone's liberty? The caller makes the point on the 13th Amendment. You know, a lot of this Constitution is vague. It's very gray. It's rarely black and white. So when people speak in terms of black and white questions, it's really misleading. Even those who call themselves originalists, there's ambiguous language. Ambiguous language has to be interpreted one way or the other. We do this with the Bible, the Torah. We do this with poetry. We do this with all kinds of ambiguous old texts. And so in this instance, the argument is the 14th Amendment says, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property. So if government were going around forcing abortions, then there might be an argument that the fetus is a person and government needs to stop that. But here the frame really is what government is doing with respect to a woman's autonomy. And from a strictly sort of legal constitutional perspective, I think the caller is exactly right that that has to be the frame. How much power does government have over women? The 14th Amendment does not give, does somehow deprive women of their power by virtue of carrying a fetus.
And Stephen Aden, there are those who argue that these particular laws that have been passed recently aren't necessary at all, that some of the laws that are non-prohibitory, that don't have to do with actually restricting the accessibility of abortion, might even be a better strategy and a better way into overturning Roe versus Wade, the Webster case in 1989, the Casey case that you mentioned in 1992. I guess neither of those cases actually involved prohibiting abortion, but Roe was examined in light of both of those decisions. I mean, are there prohibitory, non-prohibitory laws out there in some state that you're aware of that might in fact be a prime candidate for a case to come before the court?
Oh, sure there are, Tom. And to take up Kim's point real quick, Roe and the right to abortion that it found in the Constitution have been framed in terms of government versus the individual, but I think the better framing is to understand that outside of the context of abortion, there are two human individuals you're talking about, the mother and the baby. So all of us know women who are expecting, and the moment that a woman declares that she's going to keep the baby, what's in her womb goes from being an it or a fetus to being a baby, and it's celebrated. That's a little bit of schizophrenia there, but the point is that in the context of standard obstetrician gynecologist practice, OBGYNs understand that they have two patients, the mother and the baby, and they strive to protect and preserve both of them. And work toward a safe delivery. It's only in the context of abortion that we deny that there's a separate human being in the womb, and we claim that it should be entirely up to the woman to decide whether to have that baby. Just a side point. But yeah, there are a number of bills that regulate abortion in appropriate ways, health and safety measures requiring, for example, that an abortionist have the privileges, either by contract or directly, to admit a patient in an emergency situation into the hospital and follow her up there. Those are standard medical procedures that any outpatient doctor follows. If you go in for laparoscopy or colonoscopy, chances are very good your doctor will have admitting privileges, because ordinarily something doesn't go wrong, but in the very unusual circumstances where it does, you want your doctor to be able to admit you, follow you up, and take care of you. It's only in the context of abortion that that doesn't happen. The reason that it doesn't happen is because the right to abortion that was declared by Roe has been found to be so broad and sweeping by the courts that today, you know, you have New York declaring that there can be essentially no regulation of abortion. They wiped all the regulations of abortion off the books a few weeks ago with that bill that Governor Cuomo signed. That's the notion that the state has no role whatsoever to play in abortion, and it's untrue, both for the sake of women's health and safety and for the sake of the human being that's in the womb. I think the better view is to understand that we start with the understanding that it is a human being from conception. There's no question about that. It's a matter of science and biology. Anybody that denies that is denying science and biology. That's found in basic embryology textbooks that are taught in hundreds of colleges across America.
And let me give Diana Phillip a chance to respond to that assertion. Ms. Phillip, what do you think?
I'm sorry, which assertion?
The assertion that that there is no question as to the moment that life begins, and that the embryo that a woman carries from the very beginning is a person.
Not a person. I said a human being, Tom. Sorry, there is a difference.
Okay.
Person is a philosophical.
Being.
No, not to quibble, but personhood, or saying it's a person, is a philosophical statement. Saying that it's a human being, a member of the species Homo sapiens, is an uncontrovertible biological statement.
And Diana Phillip, I mean, this has, of course, long been one of the real dimensions of this argument that makes it such a difficult and emotional thing, that we don't stipulate to the facts. I mean, as to whether or not this embryo is in fact a human being, or whether it has the capacity to become a child and a human being. I mean, how do you respond to the folks who oppose access to abortion when they speak about the human beingness of these embryos? Ms. Phillip, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. The definition varies from person to person, from human being to human being, the individual carrying the pregnancy, because as women, as individuals who are childbearing, we are quite aware of the power we have in conceiving. And it really is up to us to determine whether or not to carry to term. There's communities of individuals who believe one way, religious communities who define the philosophy and the idea of when life begins another way. But this is all about whether or not the state can interfere. We have to, in the United States, honor everyone's perception and belief system when it comes to the decision, the very complicated for many decision about pregnancy, because pregnancy we have to honor in all its complexity. So it's not really the question of when life begins. And when we're talking about abortion rights, we're talking about the state interference in determining for other people when, if, and how they form their families. And then when we do so, that we parent in dignity and good health and in safety. That's really the main question. Does the state have the right to interfere? You know, remember that even with viability, that's not a legal construct. That's a medical construct. That's determined by medical practitioners. So not everybody sees this the same way. And as a country with our civil liberties, with our freedoms, we honor the idea that not everyone sees it the same way. that's why it's so important for the state to not interfere with these decisions and to allow people to form the families when they're ready and to add the existing families they may already have.
Diana Phillip is the executive director of NARAL Pro-Choice Maryland. We're joined as well by Stephen Aden, the chief legal officer and general counsel at Americans United for Life. Kim Whaley is a constitutional law scholar at the Baltimore University of Baltimore School of Law. Our phone number here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. So, Kim Whaley, when it comes to these bills that are moving through various legislatures that may end up in front of the Supreme Court, does it also work on the other side? The laws, for example, the one that Mr. Aden just referenced, the one in New York, or a law that was passed in Illinois called the Reproductive Health Act that was an attempt to make sure that if Roe were overturned, that would not affect people's access to abortion in the state of Illinois. The governor there called it a historical bill because he said, quote, "the state will now be the most progressive in the nation for reproductive health care." Are those kinds of laws also potential candidates for coming before the court and informing their decision about something like Roe?
Well, so 2 points. One has to do with what we call, lawyers call stare decisis, the idea that the Supreme Court's not going to take a case that it's already resolved and say, by the way, we were wrong. There has to be generally a compelling reason to take one of the few cases that it does every year. And so if Roe is reversed or even on the table for reversal, it'll come in the form of some other kind of dispute under really Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which really diluted the Roe test. Roe defined the right to privacy, the right to an abortion as a fundamental right, and Casey actually was more pro-government, sort of diluted that and made it more possible, I think, for some of these infringements on abortion to be constitutional. But the other point is, when we're talking about government power, and Diana was mentioning this, there's also two tiers of government at stake here. There's the federal government, and then there are the states. And the debate between who should have all the power between the federal government and the states, that's known as federalism. Some people are big believers in states' rights. They don't want a big, bad brother federal government making these determinations. There's an argument that the question of how to regulate this medical procedure and how to balance the fact that even if you agree this is a human life, it is embedded in another human life. That makes it complicated. That's not like someone walking around in the street, right? They're in another person. It affects that person. And the government has to deal with that messy, complicating sort of various balancing issues that are at stake there. You could make the argument that, listen, if the Supreme Court were to decide, listen, there is no constitutional right to abortion, then it would go back to the states. And the states and voters could decide state by state how much we want our state to be able to limit women's choices when it comes to abortion. Some states might say unlimited. We don't want any limits. Other states might have something as extreme as we've seen in Alabama, for example, but that would be resolved at the ballot booth, not at the ballot box, not by five people, individuals with life tenure and who are unaccountable politically on the Supreme Court of the United States.
Kim Whaley is a constitutional law scholar at the University of Baltimore School of Law. Her new book is going to be released on the 25th of June. It's called How to Read the Constitution and Why. Stephen Aden is the chief legal officer and general counsel at Americans United for Life. Diana Phillip is the executive director of NARAL Pro-Choice Maryland. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll try to get to a couple of your emails and calls. Our number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet @MiddayWYPR. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the future prospects of Roe v. Wade, the 1973 Supreme Court ruling that legalized abortion in the United States. As a candidate, Donald Trump promised to appoint Supreme Court justices who opposed Roe. He has made two appointments, and it remains to be seen whether or not the additions to the court of Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh will turn the tide in this emotional debate. Just yesterday, former Vice President Joe Biden, who is leading the large Democratic presidential primary field, reversed a position that he's held for a long time, saying that he now supports repeal of the Hyde Amendment. Named after former Illinois Representative Henry Hyde, it bans federal funding for abortion. It states in particular that Medicaid will not pay for an abortion except for instances of rape or incest, or if the life of the mother is in danger. The Hyde Amendment was first passed in 1976. A new poll this week from the PBS NewsHour, NPR, and Marist says 86% of Americans favor allowing abortions to protect the life or health of the mother. 24% favor making it a crime for doctors who perform abortions. And only 33% support the so-called heartbeat laws that have been passed in several states recently. Our panel today, Stephen Aden is the Chief Legal Officer and General Counsel at Americans United for Life. Kim Whaley teaches at the University of Baltimore School of Law, and Diana Phillips, she's the Executive Director of NARAL Pro-Choice Maryland. You can join us here at Midday at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR. Let's go to an email first from Mr. Aden, and then we're going to talk to Phyllis, who's on the line and being very patient holding there. Rebecca asks Mr. Aden what you think the responsibility of the father is in all of these unplanned pregnancies. We usually say that a woman, quote, becomes pregnant, while actually a woman is impregnated by a man. Do you think, for instance, that fathers should be named and compelled to provide prenatal and then child support? Stephen Aden, what do you think?
Yeah, thank you very much. Actually, they are. The law requires that fathers whose paternity is proven have a legal obligation to their children. They have a legal obligation to provide support for the mother, and that's the law, and that's appropriate. I would that many, many more fathers, both inside and outside of marriage, would see their responsibility to their children yet unborn and would provide that support, because we know that most women, as feminists have said, don't choose abortion because they think it's their best option. They choose it because they think it's their only option. They don't feel like they have support from their significant others, from their boyfriends, from their parents, from their husbands. And so they seek abortion because they consider it a last resort. That's why I think the real burgeoning of so many of these pregnancy assistance centers over the last 20 or 30 years has been such a watershed in the pro-life movement. Since about the early 90s, you've seen the number of pro-life pregnancy centers outnumber abortion centers by 4-1. So that tells me that these volunteers, many thousands of them who work in these pregnancy centers and care for women and their babies, are really the ones that care for women, in my view. And I think that's a very, very good sign that as a culture, we are embracing the life ethos.
And Diana Phillip, NARAL Pro-Choice Maryland, has done a lot of work on this issue of what you refer to as anti-choice pregnancy centers. What do you think?
I talk about anti-choice crisis pregnancy centers, the fake women's health centers. We have 70 Title X family planning clinics in the state of Maryland. We have about 20 abortion clinics, and there are approximately 45 anti-choice crisis pregnancy centers. And we did an investigative report a couple of years ago. We visited 16 out of the 45. And what we discovered is that a lot of the services and information being provided were not based on anything to do with medicine or science. And in fact, it was interesting to see that about two-thirds of them were hardly staffed and hardly were open. So the problem, however, but where these are placed is that sometimes they do occur in family planning deserts, areas in the state in which there are no other family planning providers. It's really unfortunate that once you visit these places, you find people that, you know, they're good-hearted volunteers that want to help folks with diapers and bottles and having conversations about pregnancy, but will also provide misinformation and engage in deceptive tactics and lies to people who are trying to make decisions about abortion or birth control or whether or not to continue a pregnancy. So those are the concerns that we have, is that there's no way for a lot of folks in these regions in the state of Maryland to find out whether or not the center they're walking into that claims that they're helping people with pregnancy are actually legitimate medical care providers.
Let's go to Phyllis in Falston. Phyllis, thanks for your patience. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. I have a slightly different story. In 1964, before Roe v. Wade, my husband was a civilian with the State Department, and we were stationed overseas, had access to military health care. While over there, I developed rubella, and it was considered extremely serious during pregnancy. The military doctors wanted me to abort, three of them. They insisted. And I was so sick, and I was crying, and I said, no, 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 it's my baby. Not religious. I made up my mind that I wanted the baby. She was born, she's healthy, she's a veterinarian. But my point is, it was my choice. How dare anybody tell me what to do with my body? It incentivizes me. And as I say, this is rather a reverse tale. But thank you for listening.
Well, thank you for the call. And Kim Whaley, you know, the rhetoric around this issue, pro-choice, pro-life, partial birth, abortion, the kinds of terminology that people use really does, you know, inform the narrative in so many different ways. I wonder, when it comes to picks for the Supreme Court moving forward, we have some of the people on the Democratic side, folks running for president, in particular Kirsten Gillibrand, who has said that she would absolutely have a litmus test for Supreme Court nominees, that they would support Roe v. Wade. She also says that she doesn't have all that much patience with Democrats. For example, the Democratic governor of Louisiana, I believe it is, who signed the very restrictive bill that Louisiana legislature passed restricting abortions, says, as a Democrat, that's got to be a line in the sand. How do you see the politicization of the court informing what's happening as we move forward?
Well, the politicization of the court is unfortunate on many, many levels. I mean, I actually worked with Brett Kavanaugh many years ago. I was a associate independent counsel on the Whitewater investigation. He's a brilliant, brilliant jurist. I don't know how anyone can sniff out a litmus test on this issue so long as the person being promoted or nominated for the Supreme Court is intellectually honest in his or her jurisprudence. There certainly are people out there that would ignore the legal nuances here, and that would be a problem. But the fact that we're in a world where the court is seen as a political body, I think they've made some decisions that that underscores that concept, is really unfortunate, because what the court does has to be considered legitimate by the American populace for us to, as a population, to buy into the legal process, to buy into the rule of law. If there's something comes down, we don't like it. If we feel like the game was fair, the umpires were calling balls and strikes fairly, then we live with, you know, the fact that our kid didn't win the baseball game. But if we feel like that it's politicized and it's not based on intellectually honest legal concepts, then I think the whole structure of the legal system could fall apart. And I wanted to make one other point about this concept of life, and that is, of course, the Eighth Amendment and the fact that we have a death penalty in this country. The Supreme Court has held that the government can kill people, notwithstanding that the Due Process Clause says refers to life, liberty, and property. And the reason that that's considered okay is because, again, there's a balancing test, that there are other values that we adhere to as a culture that the government thinks about, including retribution and fairness to the families and to the victim. And so the balancing tests, we cannot evade them. And I think the Supreme Court, whoever's on the Supreme Court, is going to have to grapple mightily with the fact that we're not dealing with, as I think all of the panelists have said today, we're not dealing with a standalone human being. We're dealing with however you want to define it, a citizen or someone who was literally born into the earth or into the world out of the womb. That's the mother, and then a fetus. Those are two interests, and it's just not a black and white issue. And I think the court needs to and will understand that.
Yeah, Tom, can I have a brief rejoinder? I agree with Kim, but I think that the Supreme Court has created its own problem by finding these unenumerated, unspecified rights in the Constitution, like the right to abortion. I don't believe that the Supreme Court was ever supposed to be the final arbiter on ultimate critical life decisions like this. And by assuming that power in Roe versus Wade, it's created a regime where, as Kim said, five unelected life-tenured members of the court can decree these questions for all of us, which is why at Americans United for Life, we think that the easiest and most logical way to go is to return the issue to the states and to the people where it belongs and let them vote. And as she noted, you know,
what
in
makes
some
the
states
more
be,
what makes the states smarter about this than the federal
government?
They're
not necessarily. I mean, they're elected legislatures, which is an improvement over nine unelected individuals. For one thing, they're deliberative bodies. And furthermore, the oversight of medical care and provision is entrusted to the states. In virtually every other context, the Supreme Court has said, we have given states the authority to determine medical issues. And so that's the right way to go. And that's the way that I hope they will ultimately in overturning Roe and returning the matter to the people.
We have a heartbreaking email from Caitlin who says, I became pregnant with twins, which I learned very early in my pregnancy, that in my 12-week checkup, that one of the fetuses had a chromosomal abnormality and would not make it past a year of life. The medical advice I received was to give the healthy fetus the best chance of making it. I would have to do selective reduction. So, Mr. Aiden, she's asking you, what is the position about Caitlin's dilemma? Should she have kept both fetuses, even though it would have endangered the health of the other one? And I got to ask you to be real quick. I'm sorry, but we're running out
first,
of time.
As quick as I can be, Caitlin, I am so sorry. I'm not a doctor. I think in a situation like that, if a baby, a fetus, is truly incompatible with life, then you know, that ought to be taken into consideration with your doctor. I have friends who have lost infants in the womb and shortly after that because of anencephaly. In similar situations, they had a funeral, they had hospice available, they grieved, they mourned with their friends and loved ones, and I'm sorry.
All right, we're almost out of time. We just have a few seconds left. Diana Phillip, I want to give you the last word. The bill that Speaker Bush, now deceased, proposed to strengthen access to abortion laws here in Maryland did not succeed last session. Do you expect that it would succeed? It will succeed next year.
Let's be very clear. We codified Roe in 1991, and we affirmed it by a ballot initiative by 62% of the vote in 1992. So if Roe should fall, the abortion care will remain in our state legal, and we're very fortunate for that. I can understand there's many folks that are trying to figure out the best way to strengthen their laws. A constitutional amendment is an interesting idea. However, we look forward to sitting down with our legislative leaders and making a decision about what would be the best strategy for Maryland.
Great. Well, I appreciate all of you participating in our conversation today. Thank you so much. Diana Phillip from the NARAL Pro-Choice Maryland, Stephen Aiden from the Americans United for Life, and Kim Whaley from the University of Baltimore School of Law. Her new book is out later this month. It's called How to Read the Constitution and Why. That's it for us today. Coming up Monday, we're going to talk about Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's failure to form a government in Israel and everything that's going on in the Middle East. We want to thank Bottoms Up Bagels for providing lunch today. Bottoms Up Bagels is a small batch pop-up bagel shop preparing hand-rolled New Jersey-style bagels, house-cured lox, and specialty cream cheeses inspired by traditions of bagel making dating back to the 1940s. Bottoms Up Bagels offers customized catering packages of all kinds. You can find them at the JFX and Waverly Farmers Markets and at bottomsupbagels.com. Midday's director and engineer is Luke Spicknall, Rob Sivak, Sienna Greaves, Kathleen Cahill produce our program. Jamila Krempel is our digital producer. Austin Cogman from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. Our interns are Rob Velasquez and Margot Kohler. We want to give a shout-out finally to a terrific bluegrass jazz-inspired group called Nick and Luke. We'd hoped to have them on the show this afternoon. Couldn't do it, but they are playing a job at the Creative Alliance tonight at 8 o'clock. You should check them out. They're terrific. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great weekend.